Ridoan Taghi, one of the Netherlands' most wanted criminals, has been sentenced to life in prison. The case against the drug cartel leader and 16 other members of his crime gang related to several murders, including a journalist.
Haiti is on a brink of becoming a failed state. A gangland rebellion is ripping through the republic. The prime minister has announced he will step down once a transitional presidential council is in place. But will the gang leaders at the heart of the fighting reject that plan?
Gunmen in the northwestern Nigerian state of Kaduna have abducted more than 100 pupils aged between 8 and 15. The children were in school assembly when bandits on motorcycles rode in and took them away.
A gunfight in Rio de Janeiro, reportedly between drug traffickers and another force in the city, one that many might not have heard of. They're known as the militia. They've been quietly expanding the areas they control to cover more than 2 million of Rio's inhabitants.
Welcome to The Index, a podcast by the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime. This series delves into the Global Organized Crime Index and takes a look at some of the biggest threats facing countries and regions around the world. In 2009, President Lula da Silva launched one of the most ambitious housing projects in Brazil's history, Minha Casa, Minha Vida, meaning my house, my life. According to the 2010 census, 6% of Brazil's total population lived in favelas. This new social development policy set about to increase access to adequate housing. With over 4 million houses built in the first decade of the program, it aimed to tackle the long-standing housing shortfalls that contributed to the spread of the country's vast informal settlements in and around cities. But Brazil has a serious problem with mafia-style groups, with a score of 8 out of 10, according to the Global Organized Crime Index, placing the country third in South America. One such group are the so-called militias, made up of former and serving members of military police or law enforcement. The militia groups have sought to profit from the housing market, and many residents now face the threat of violence, firearms, and even expulsion from their newly acquired homes. Militia involvement in the land and the real estate sector is widespread across Rio de Janeiro, as is their involvement in markets such as internet connectivity, water, security, and so on. Militias profit by extorting neighborhoods and controlling these industries, contributing to the high levels of extortion and protection racketeering that we see in the OC Index, with Brazil scoring 7 out of 10. And these services are often provided in full view of state officials and enforcement agencies. Overall, criminality scores in Brazil are high, with a score of 6.77 out of 10. Globally, that places Brazil 22nd out of 193 countries. With me to take a closer look at the situation in Rio's urban areas is Antonio Sampaio, thematic lead on cities and illicit economies at the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime, and Nicholas Pope, research fellow in the Department of War Studies at King's College London. Together, they have co-authored the report, Coercive Brokers, Militias and Urban Governance in Rio de Janeiro. Nick and Antonio, thank you for joining us. Nick, can I start with you first? How have militias come to control so much of residential areas in Rio?
Thanks for the question, Thin. I think it's important to understand that militias, at least in Rio de Janeiro, derive much of their power through residential areas. So it's where the populations are. So where the population go, there are kind of opportunities for control, opportunities to make money, opportunities to create revenues, and therefore opportunities for social political capital as well. And this is what leads them to have different levels of control. And we're not just talking about any population here. We're talking about populations in a very geographically specific area of the city. So these areas are often new regions that are urbanizing in quite fast ways. And these figures, these violent figures, have always been part of slicing up and dicing up parts of the land, distributing the land, selling it off, buying and selling houses. This region is quite new in urban terms. It used to be very agricultural, but as markets are expanding very quickly in this area, these actors have a specific role in facilitating these processes in these regions.
Thanks, Nick. Antonio, can I come to you next? So how involved are the militias in urban expansion in Rio? So for example, are they involved in constructing new buildings?
Yeah, so over time, with these deficiencies in urban planning and in infrastructure building in Rio de Janeiro, at least the services provided by the state, the militias came to absorb a lot of these roles. And one of these roles that we look particularly in our study is the role of the militias in land and real estate, which is something that is a widespread phenomenon in many countries affected by organized crime and affected by armed conflict, but is not as well understood as, for instance, drug trafficking and other more classic roles of these criminal organizations. So the militias basically, through the power and the control they have over these communities, they acquire, they grab land illegally, and they start building residential buildings or other types of businesses, and then they sell it in an illicit manner to communities, many of which might not know that they are illicit or illegal, but they become involved and dependent on the militias that sold them their land. And through this control of the land, the militias are able to then establish some other businesses, some other forms of exploitation, businesses that are aligned to them, forms of control of these populations. They can provide insecurity in exchange for money, in exchange for extortion. So through this building of these illicit areas, the militias are able to strengthen the control over populations in Rio.
Nick, so both you and Antonio have talked about how this happened, where this happened, but what does this control, this militia control in this area actually mean for the residents and the level of violence?
Yeah, I mean, the violence is a really key part of this. And, you know, it's a really central part of how militias maintain their control and power in these regions. So we see quite explicit and quite overt forms of violence in the forms of physical violence. Actually, you know, one of the most prevalent forms of violence is very everyday forms of violence. So we see actually within militia-dominated communities a kind of wide sense of fear and an ability of residents to speak out against things that they might not like. You know, they're silenced politically, they're unable to express their opinions about certain things. So the violence is maybe less visible than we see in other parts of the city. So we see quite visible forms of violence in drug trafficking communities with armed violence and shootouts. But actually in militia-controlled communities, we see a lot less of this. And there's actually a much higher number of disappearances, people going missing. We see bodies found in regions around militia-dominated areas.
That's really interesting, that comparison with, you know, sort of less visible or less overt form of violence in these areas. Antonio, in the report that you and Nick did, you talked about the militias, how they control services like transportation, water, and electricity. Can you explain how they do this?
Yes, the control that the militias have over public services is part of what you and Nick were discussing about less overt forms of violence. It's a form of economic violence because the militias are established quite prolific range of services that they control and they sell to residents. I've looked at this issue of urban violence and territorial control by criminal groups in quite a few cities, and I've never come across something as ubiquitous as the services that the militias control in Rio. So it started with the provision of security. They tend to be formed, at least at the beginning, very heavily by former or off-duty police officers. So they came to the communities and they said, you have no security, no real security provided by the state. We are going to offer you security against potential robbers, against drug traffickers, in exchange for money, in exchange for this contribution or tax that you're going to pay us. But then this control evolved into a wide range of public services that place the militias almost like a state within a state. So very often they control the distribution of cooking gas, which is very important for people because there is no piped gas often in informal or low-income communities. Also provision of electricity, transportation. Also early on, the militias came to control through unlicensed buses or minibuses, minivans. Recently, a very important service that they came to control is internet provision. So also going through telecommunications. I was talking to a journalist in Brazil and she was traveling through the city as part of her investigations, and she started to come across very frequently with cables on the street that were being cut. And she started to investigate and she discovered that those cables were the internet cables from illicit providers that the militias were cutting to be able to establish their own services that the residents are pretty much forced to adopt. So the residents end up often with less quality of services and very frequently paying a higher price. So it is a form of economic violence, if you will, but certainly a form of holding back the development and the prosperity of these communities that are held hostage to the whims of the militias that control them and often threaten and impede the licit providers or any competitors from arriving there.
If I can just add on to your point there, Antonio, I think militias are helping residents also in some ways to access resources and services that they might not be able to access through the formal markets. So, you know, we see these informal markets emerging, illicit markets around television, transport, and the utilities as well. But often some of the companies are not reaching residents in the Western. So I think militias play a role in helping to extend some of these services and resources to residents.
Thank you for that. I have one more question for you, Antonio, before I turn back to Nick with a few more questions. What is the difference between militias and Rio's infamous drug gangs? Are there any difference?
Yes, that's a good question and one that I have discussed with colleagues in Brazil and in Rio for a long time now. The difference has become more tenuous, more sort of subtle in recent years, especially in the 2000s when the militias started to become more violent and more visible. And famously, newspapers started to call them militias, whereas before they might have been called criminal organizations or mafia organizations. In the 2000s, the militias were more frequently composed by the military police officers. They were more focused on the provision of security or security rackets with a discourse of community protection. So this discourse of protecting the communities against drug trafficking as a sort of illicit or at least legitimate form of service was more present, more prominent. And many communities actually publicly said that they welcomed the militias. Many communities welcomed this presence and visibly embraced this narrative of the militias as a positive actor in the communities until more and more of the violence and the threatening aspects of the militias started to emerge. And famously, reporters of a local newspaper called O Dia, that they were doing an investigation into the militias and they were apprehended by the militias and they were tortured. And this case helped to open everyone's eyes to the dark side of the militias. So back to your question, today, gradually as the militias expanded into public service provision and expanded the range of illicit businesses, one of these businesses that some militias expanded has been drug trafficking, which of course placed them very close to the business model, the core model of the what is usually called the drug trafficking gang. So long before the militias, the main actors, the main sort of violent non-state actors in Rio were the drug trafficking gangs, such as the Red Command, the Comando Vermelho, and now also the Third Pure Command, the Terceiro Comando Puro. And these groups still exist. They establish territorial control, very fierce, very threatening territorial control, publicly displaying rifles and a very violent and very visible form of securitized control. The militias are more discreet. They don't display the weapons very openly, also because they don't need to, because they often have alliances with police and other state agencies that until recently tended to have a more sort of lenient approach towards the militias. So they didn't need to protect the territories against the police operations as fiercely as the drug gangs. But essentially, the militias are still a specific and more differentiated type of criminal organization because of their close alliances to the state. Many experts in Rio that have been studying the drug gangs, there's also a cultural difference in that they come from backgrounds and that tend to be more humble than the militias. So they lack even the tools and the ability to circulate in the environments of power and political decision-making that the militias circulate in. So the militias, they tend to have more infiltration into the state because of that.
Thanks for that explanation, Antonio. Nick, can I come back to you? Do you think that corruption plays a role in allowing this to happen?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It has several different ways that it manifests in the urban expansion process. So, I mean, we just have to look at the ways that, you know, state resources and budgets are allocated and diverted to certain militia areas. You know, we see relationships between politicians and militia leaders, militia groups at both the local, you know, municipal level, but also the state level, less so at the federal level, but we do see it happen. We see the ways that, you know, title deeds and authorizations are given, and sometimes there's fraud involved in reproducing these authorizations and deeds that militias use to account for certain properties and property developments. Officials and state officials, police, security officials are bribed to turn a blind eye and not be involved, or they're invited to be part of certain deals and business engagements with the militia as well. We see also kind of, you know, clientelism forms a big part of this as well in terms of building community support. The ways that resources are funneled into communities to garner political support for certain politicians that support the militias as well. And we also see, you know, from the profits and revenues that are made from militias, you know, money laundering is kind of featuring quite heavily as well. So there's quite a few different ways that corruption factors into this.
Given all that both of you have said around, you know, the involvement of corruption, the militias' infiltration in political and power circles, what is the state and law enforcement doing to combat the problem?
Well, this is a very good question. And I think, you know, actually the quite a simple answer is not so much. Part of the problem is that, you know, the militias are very political and they're embedded within the political apparatus. You know, they have allies in very high and powerful places, especially in the state of Rio. You know, we're talking up to the kind of, you know, executive level. Policing is in Brazil is a state level issue. You know, we have federal police, but they don't really do so much in this area of local policing within the city. So the state level is, the state is organizing the policing. And actually, you know, when you put a police chief in place that is an ally of the political class, you know, there's kind of certain decisions that have to be made about how policing is done, where resources are spent. And actually much of the resources are spent in other parts of the city. You know, a classic example of this is during the UPP, so the pacification police, when they were funded, many of the UPP stations were in drug trafficking communities. There was only one. And that was in the Batang community, which is where there was a kidnapping of the journalist, right? So in the West Zone in general, we don't see much focus on the militias. Every now and again, there's a crackdown and a bust and some activity that's covered in the media. And it demonstrates there is some kind of awareness of this from the state level, but we don't see a kind of sustained campaign and a strategy to really root out this type of activity because it is so embedded within the political establishment and the political class.
And another dimension is, I think there has been a gradual and subtle change in the security approach because of the visibility and the public pressure that the power, the sheer power of the militias has brought to this problem. There was a study by researchers in Rio about the areas that receive more and less police operations. So the military police in Rio is famous worldwide for its very brutal, securitized, militarized police operations, entering guns blazing in usually in favelas with heavy costs to the lives for local residents. And those operations tended to be concentrated in areas of the drug gangs, the Red Command and its rivals in Rio. And this study revealed that that is indeed the case. So they counted the number of operations and the areas of the militias tended to have less. Whether this is due to corrupt influences, to a sort of an ideological or a lingering cultural feeling that the militias have a positive role as vigilantes in the communities, or a combination of both corruption and the sort of cultural perceptions is debated in Rio. But the fact is the militias have had less pressure from the authorities. In recent years, I think because of the public pressure, there have been more investigative operations by state and federal police authorities in this matter that have led to some militia being led to the justice system. But as Nick said, we still don't have a comprehensive, more systematic, strategic approach to root out the power of the militias. Since the investigative committee that the state legislative body led back in the late 2000s, there hasn't really been large-scale attempt to understand the state phenomenon now and to root it out. It's basically being led by activists and journalists, and the government itself still is playing catch up on this very important challenge for Rio and for Brazil.
And I think those are really, you know, insightful comments to end this podcast with. So thank you for joining us on this episode of The Index, and a special thank you to Antonio Sampaio and Nicholas Pope for being part of this discussion. Now, in the podcast notes, you'll find links to Antonio and Nicholas's report on this issue, as well as to the Brazil country profile. Remember that the Global Organized Crime Index is a totally free resource, and it's available to everyone. Just head over to ocindex.net. We'll be back with another episode of The Index soon. I'm Thin Lewin. Thanks for listening.